Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that a huge Chinese property conglomerate, Evergrande, could default on its $300 billion in debt and trigger China's Lehman Brothers moment in the way the panic from the collapse of the Wall Street giant led to the 2008 crash. Joining us is Victor Shi, a professor of political science at the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego, who has published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rate, and is currently constructing a large database on biographical information of elites in China. The author of Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability, Duration, Financial Control, and Institutions, we will discuss the fact that China's central bank has plenty of liquidity, but Xi Jinping's crackdown on entrepreneurs and billionaires, along with movie stars, is unsettling China's business community and could lead to an exodus of capital and international businesses from China as Xi moves to curtail the power of any possible rivals to the primacy of the Chinese Communist Party. Then we'll speak with Martha Piskowski, who is an environmental watchdog reporter at the El Paso Times, who was previously a freelance journalist in Mexico reporting on the environment and immigration. She joins us to discuss her article at the El Paso Times, "Haitian Migrants Face Tough Choices in Del Rio Amid Crackdown on the Texas Border," and the distressing optics of Border Patrol officers on horseback with whips rounding up Haitian refugees. Then finally, we'll get an update on the election today in Canada, the second in 2 years that Prime Minister Trudeau called in the hope of increasing his majority in Parliament, which polls indicate may turn out to be a bad bet for Trudeau's Liberal Party. Joining us is Richard Johnston, a Professor Emeritus of Political Science, who until recently held the Canada Research Chair in Public Opinion, Elections and Representation at the University of British Columbia. The author of a number of books, including Public Opinion and Public Policy in Canada, Questions of Confidence, and The Canadian Party System, An Analytic History. We will discuss how the COVID pandemic, which the Canadians have handled better than most countries, has become the main election issue. And before we go to our first guest, now that I have resigned in protest from Pacifica and its Los Angeles station KPFK, we have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Victor Shi, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and is currently engaged in a study of how the coalition formation strategies of founding leaders had a profound impact on the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as constructing a large database on biographical information of elites in China. And he's the author of Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability, Duration, Financial Control, and Institutions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Shi.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Victor. And the huge Chinese conglomerate Evergrande owes about $300 billion. It seems to be scrambling around to try and raise funds. It's tried to sell off some of its subsidiaries. It got into soccer stadiums, soccer schools, electric cars. It tried to offload its electric car division without any success. Apparently, it's asking its own employees to pitch in money, which seems extraordinary. And many investors are crowding its offices in various cities across China, not just in the south, where Evergrande began. So is there a possibility that Evergrande could collapse and that could be a kind of Lehman Brothers moment for China?
So, you know, I think the possibility of an actual Lehman moment, which, of course, in the U.S. triggered an all-out panic in the financial system, is relatively small in China because the central bank is aware of the situation. They're standing by with a lot of liquidity. Most of the banks in China are state-owned, so they're in constant contact with the central bank. And they will do whatever the central bank order them to do, you know, including writing down debt, you know, and also receiving mass amount of funding from the central bank. Having said that, however, I think if Evergrande were to go down the road of more defaults and also inability, more importantly, inability to complete and deliver properties that they have sold already to buyers, it will have a significant impact on other real estate developers and on the property market in China in general. So for one, to give you one example, if Evergrande were to cut prices of its apartments that they're selling dramatically, other property developers in similar areas will also need to cut prices. And that actually may trigger margin calls for these other property developers, because property developers in China, they borrow on the basis of the worth of the housing stock they are developing. And if suddenly that worth were to decline, their lenders will cut their ability to borrow and demand money back. So this is a potential trigger for some kind of contagion effect.
Well, apparently interest payments are due, and $100 million of interest payments are due this week, and the stock has lost 80% of its value this year. So I imagine, is that why people are camping out in the lobbies of its buildings, you know, wailing, yeah, I've lost my entire fortune? Is that, these are the sort of new middle-class investors in China who may not be sophisticated but have lost all of their life savings?
Yeah, so the people were protesting in Evergrande offices all over China include two types of people. One, who are high net worth investors who have lent money to Evergrande through these things called trust products. The risks associated with trust products are well known, and these high net worth investors by and large have known about the risk of lending to property development companies like Evergrande. The other class of protesters today are middle class buyer of properties who are afraid that if the company were to go bankrupt, the apartments which they have paid for either fully or partially will not be completed and will not be delivered to them. And in that case, their savings will have been wiped out. So I think for those people who, including, you know, conservative investors, many of them even civil servants who work for the Chinese government, you know, if they were to lose their life savings in these incompleted apartments, that would be a huge shock to the middle class in China. So I think that the Chinese government hopefully is aware of the situation and hopefully is thinking of ways of avoiding this situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Victor Shi, who is a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California in San Diego. He is constructing a large database of biographical information on elites in China and is the author of Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability, Duration, Financial Control, and Institutions. So tell me then about whether or not, I don't know what Xi Jinping's relationship is with this company and its billionaire leader known as Hui Ka-yan in Cantonese, who was once the country's richest man. Xi is now going after a lot of entrepreneurs and wealthy, successful businessmen in China, along with movie stars and others. He's conducting this campaign attacking effeminate men as well. It's a very odd thing that's happening there. How serious is this rollback in terms of entrepreneurs and successful capitalists. They've normally been untouchable. So I'm not sure whether it's selective on his part, or what's the story with this particular capitalist? Is he getting attacked by Xi as well?
Yeah, so I think it is somewhat selective, but I think overall it will have wide-ranging implications for the development of market economy in China. In the short term, of course, Xi Jinping's objective is to assert power relative to these billionaires who have become increasingly influential in the political system in recent years. In the case of Hui Ga-in and Evergrande, they have become politically very influential because the company was willing to invest billions of dollars in second and third tier cities in China, thus becoming the main engine of growth in these cities, the main engine of investment in these cities, providing the credential for, you know, having economic performance for these officials who want to get promoted, but perhaps more importantly, rent-seeking opportunities, corruption opportunities for these officials who, of course, like money, just like most people. So he was becoming very influential within the political system, and Xi Jinping might have targeted him because of this growing influence. Xi Jinping seems to have very little tolerance for political power outside of the Chinese Communist Party within China, and sometimes even sort of outside of China. And so the recent crackdown on technology entrepreneurs, on property entrepreneurs, is very much in this vein. But the cost of this is that the billionaires of China today are very savvy. They're very internationalized. In the case of Hui Ga-in, he has a lot of wealth socked up overseas. He's got, by some accounts, billions and billions of dollars socked away overseas already. He can completely withdraw from the China market and invest elsewhere in the world. And I think more entrepreneurs, more billionaires in China may take this path of leaving the China market and investing somewhere else.
So what's the broader purpose of Xi's attack on entrepreneurs, capitalists, billionaires, and what they call sissy men?
Oh, wow. The sissy man phenomenon, that's a separate thing. That's more of a cultural thing. But the recent attack on tech entrepreneurs and property entrepreneurs has to do with, I think, his fundamental fear that some other force in China is going to become more powerful than the Chinese Communist Party, which, after all, is the organization which he heads. To give Xi some credit, he grew up within the organization, and I think he has a very deep loyalty to the survival and the relative power of the Chinese Communist Party. He doesn't want to see the party fall behind relative to other social forces, and so he's using the power of the party to make sure that the party remains supreme within China. But economically, that will have enormous costs to the Chinese economy, in my opinion. Already, we're seeing that reflected on the market valuation of many of China's leading technology companies and now property developers and casinos. Collectively, these companies have lost close to $2 trillion in market capitalization and may well lose even more. That wealth would have been private sector wealth that, mainly private investors in China could have invested in a much more efficient way than the state can in a lot of developing industries, thus helping China propel further into the digital age. But now a lot of that wealth is gone, and the ability of the private sector in China to invest will be much weaker. So that's going to have a lot of costs to the Chinese economy.
But is he scapegoating these people because of these economic problems, which we're talking about with the possible collapse of Evergrande? In other words, so much of the propaganda now that he's pushing out coming from these kind of bloggers that the state media promote talking about returning to the red and revolutionary, you know, going back to the Red Guards idea of the Cultural Revolution. Is it possible that she is planning on a major distraction like a Cultural Revolution to bring back Mao?
So I think he has succeeded quite a bit already to bring back, and you know, the Mao period, not the Cultural Revolutionary period of the Mao period, but the pre-Cultural Revolution period of the Mao period. Sort of he came of age from the late 1950s to early 1960s before the chaos of the Cultural Revolution, but at a time when the party really controlled every aspect of life in China, especially sort of the media. There were no private actors in the media, and the party controlled the media 100% and produced content that was wholly consistent with socialist value. So I think for Xi Jinping, he would like to bring back that age to some extent. You know, of course, he has said on a number of occasions that, of course, there is now room for the private sector in contemporary China. There is room, and indeed, the government should encourage high technology in the Chinese government. But the overwhelming power of the party from the early 60s, as well as especially culturally, complete control by the party in the cultural sphere, are things that Xi Jinping would like to bring back to China. And I think he has succeeded to a large extent already.
And this wolf warrior stuff and sissy men, how does that play into his vision?
So those are, again, very different things. The wolf warrior is just a more aggressive style of Chinese diplomacy. He has said on a number of occasions that Chinese diplomats must develop a voice, you know, must really speak out loud China's economic and political interests. And of course, then the diplomats heard the order from the top leadership and have responded in kind, sometime I would say to the detriment of Chinese interests, right? So if Chinese diplomats were to be, you know, more moderate in some of the things that they have said and done, perhaps more countries like Australia, Japan, and Korea would hesitate more as the U.S. call on them to take a harder stance vis-a-vis China. But because of this very aggressive diplomatic style, I think more countries are willing to side with the U.S. in this pushback against China, again, to really the detriment of the Chinese government. I think some diplomats in China are aware of this problem. We're seeing Qin Gang, who's the new ambassador from China to the United States. He's on Twitter, and it seems like he has a more moderate voice, mainly, you know, for a tactical reason, because he recognizes that a more aggressive style may not be beneficial to China.
So what do you think will be the Chinese response to the Quad meeting this week?
Well, I think it will not be a good one. Hopefully the rhetorics will be toned down a little bit. You know, because I don't think China can really sort of criticize the U.S. for having things like the Quad meeting. China has for years, tried to rally countries around China into a sort of quasi-alliance in the Shanghai Cooperative Organization. The Shanghai Cooperative Organization has become increasingly formalized. They're doing a lot of military exercises together. So China is doing exactly the same thing. I really don't think Beijing has any solid ground on which to criticize the United States and allied countries.
But will the Quad, which is the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India, will it be an effective organization to blunt China's expanding military influence in the Indo-Pacific?
I think, you know, I don't know all the details of the Quad, but it seems that they're doing more military exercises. And I think this is will be a have a deterrence effect on China. So again, you know, if you were only were to look at Chinese government criticism of the United States, you would not know that, in fact, the Chinese Navy has been expanding at a clip of, you know, 20% in terms of tonnage that they launch on the sea. So growing at 20-30% annually for the past 10 years. So the Chinese Navy is expanding very, very aggressively. And so for the U.S. to be able to call on allied countries like Australia, India, and Japan to hold regular exercises will have a deterrence effect on the Chinese Navy.
Well, Victor Shi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Shi, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and is currently constructing a large database on biographical information of elites in China, and is the author of Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability, Duration, Financial Control, and Institutions. Going to take a brief station break and back discussing the crackdown on the Texas-Mexican border and the distressing optics of Border Patrol officers on horseback with whips rounding up Haitian refugees.
Short-sighted businessmen, and nothing lasts for long. Nothing lasts for long. Nothing lasts for long. Chinese cafe, we'd be living on our dimes. We'd be playing, you'd give your love so sweetly.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Martha Piskarski, who is an environmental watchdog reporter at the El Paso Times. She was previously a freelance journalist in Mexico, reporting on the environment and immigration. And she has an article at the El Paso Times, Haitian Migrants Face Tough Choices in Del Rio Amid Crackdown on the Texas-Mexican Border. Obviously, the photo that we've seen, or the video we've seen of the Border Patrol officer on horseback cracking a whip at fleeing Haitians, it's a pretty sad image. It evokes all kinds of horrible historical precedents. And so how did it strike you being there on the scene?
Yes, well, it was really shocking. I think those of us who had been covering the story, there had been the U.S. and Mexican officials had been allowing the Haitians and other people to come back to the Mexican side for food and water because there are not adequate supplies in the encampment. And then all of a sudden yesterday, there was a very quick change of approach, and people were headed back to the U.S. side, and all of a sudden the mounted Border Patrol officers told them they were out of time and tried to block their way. So those of us who were there reporting were really kind of watching it in horror, to be honest.
And were the people able to flee and avoid being trampled by the horses and have the whips lash them?
Yeah, eventually they did allow the people in the river to go through. I was there later in the evening and people were going back and forth once again, but it was a pretty clear message and show of force that I think is, you know, meant to deter people going forward.
But my understanding is that a number of the Haitian immigrants were put aboard aircraft and flown back to Haiti. Some of them didn't even know that they were going to Haiti until they landed in Haiti. So what was the process then between the Border Patrol on horseback charging in these immigrants and cracking their whips and then the people that were flown out of the country? Are they arresting them, putting them in buses, driving them off? What's the process?
So everyone in the encampment, they are, you know, willfully turning themselves into U.S. authorities. They are not trying to sneak into the country. And their hope is that they will be able to open asylum cases. However, DHS has made very clear that they will be using Title 42, which is a public health ordinance that dates back to the beginning of the pandemic where the U.S. has been not been allowing people to open asylum claims and immediately removing them from the country. So that is what we understand is happening with the Haitians and other people in the encampment. However, there hasn't been much transparency about, you know, the exact process.
Well, apparently, according to the Del Rio mayor, Bruno Lozano, he was at a news conference on Sunday, said that these removal flights were underway and that they were leaving Del Rio for San Antonio, where they were flown off to Port-au-Prince. And we're talking about 2,000 people being relocated. So from your position there as an eyewitness, what numbers remain and how many people have been sent off on planes back to Haiti, and what number are staying here or being given access to asylum claims? Because I thought the door was pretty much closed on asylum claims in this country.
Yes, I think the vast majority are being put on flights to Haiti or whichever other country they're from. There have been some reports of a number of people being released and being able to travel by bus to reunite with family members or sponsors, but I think that's the small minority. And there still are, I think, upwards of 10,000 people at the encampment. The peak number I heard was 14,000, and now they are trying to move over 2,000 people a day. So it's still going to be, you know, it's not going to be overnight that this encampment is dismantled, but U.S. officials are moving as quickly as possible.
So tell us about the conditions there. But let's start with the weather. Apparently, it's incredibly hot. And that was why people were going across the border into Mexico, simply to get water, because the temperature's in the 90s.
Yes, it's very hot here. I'm checking the weather right now. We're at 99 degrees, and people are living under a bridge. So that's really the only shade they have, and it's not at all healthy or sustainable going forward.
And there are children among the adults, right? These are families, are they, of Haitians?
Yes, there's children. It's hard to, you know, get exact numbers, but I have seen a lot of children while I've been reporting.
So how are these Haitians treated in Mexico? They're retreating across the border to get food and water. One would assume that the Mexican side is being more hospitable than the American side.
To some extent, I think there's just more access. There really isn't any, official humanitarian aid set up on the Mexican side. People are just going and buying at little shops or stands. But on the U.S. side, they cannot leave this area right next to the river, so they just don't have anywhere to get supplies.
And again, I'm speaking with Martha Paskowski, who's an environmental watchdog reporter at the El Paso Times. She was previously a freelance journalist in Mexico reporting on the environment and immigration, and she joins us from the border at the Rio Grande near Del Rio, Texas. So how did they get there in the first place? How did this encampment grow to 14,000 people under a bridge right on the border with El Paso and Del Rio?
Yes, so many of these people have been traveling for months. Haitians often arrive first in South America. It's very difficult for them to directly enter Mexico, and then they travel by land north. So there are also many Haitians who settled in Brazil and Chile and were working there, but with economic downturns, they found it difficult to stay in those countries. And there's also a lot of people with family ties in the U.S. So all of these factors have played into people arriving on the U.S. border. And with access so restricted during the pandemic, I think word started to spread that here in Del Rio it was slightly easier to gain access to the border. And that's why people started coming here in such large numbers.
So is there any American aid workers? Do they have access to these people? Are they, if this is an impromptu encampment, what kind of help are they getting from on the U.S. side?
the agencies here say they are being provided food and water and that there are EMTs on hand. Journalists have not been able to go into the encampment, so it's very difficult to, you know, confirm firsthand the conditions. But everyone I spoke to on the Mexican side, they said there's not enough food, there's not enough water, and there's nowhere to sleep. People are just sleeping wherever they can on the ground.
Well, if there's 14,000 people on the ground under a bridge, I'm trying to visualize this. Could you describe the scene in terms of, it's got to be pretty crowded, isn't it?
Yes, well, we've been trying to, there's also a restriction on the airspace over the bridge. So even something like drone photos is very restricted at the moment. This is the international bridge between Mexico and the U.S., so it is quite large, and they've also shut down all traffic across the bridge. So the river is relatively shallow in this location, and people are able to wade across. And then it's this open area underneath the bridge, but before kind of reaching all of the infrastructure of the port of entry. So it's on U.S. soil, but it's a bit of a no man's land, and people started to congregate there.
But the people that are being hauled off in buses, my understanding is that Haitians are being pulled off buses in Mexico. Is that right? Describe the scene of when they cross to Mexico to get water and food and then return to the United States side, do they cross the river, do they, or they cross the bridge?
They've been crossing the river. And at this point, Mexico has
the river?
Set up. The river, it's about waist deep. It fluctuates somewhat, but that's also one of the reasons that this is a more appealing point of entry, because elsewhere along the U.S.-Mexico border, the river is really too dangerous to cross. And as you're asking, Mexico has set up additional immigration checkpoints on the highways leading here. So it is now very difficult to access Ciudad Acuña, which is on the Mexican side, and that they've sort of been choking off entry into the city to prevent more people from arriving here.
So if Haitians are being hauled off buses in Mexico, this is before they get to Ciudad Acuña, right? Before they get near Del Rio. And then what happens to them? They get turned away?
Yes, Mexico at this point, they do have deportations to Haiti as well. I'm not sure if the people who have been detained in the last few days will be deported or if they're being held in detention. But Mexico also has a very robust immigration enforcement infrastructure and a lot of the time serves as a sort of filter for people who are trying to reach the U.S. border. It's very difficult to transit through Mexico.
Well, my understanding is that we know that Haiti is a very poor country and that people live on incredibly meager wages there. And if they're going from South America as far away as Chile, or making their way all the way up through South America and Central America into Mexico and then up to the American border, and then now they've got this encampment under the bridge on the American side and they keep going back across, wading across the Rio Grande to get water and food on the Mexican side, which they have to pay for at these little stands, I can't imagine these people have much money left.
Yeah, that's what I was hearing yesterday from people as they got the news that deportations were starting. They've really spent everything they have and are at a point of desperation, but they don't want to turn back and don't really have the resources to go anywhere else at this point.
And you say the food and water that they're getting on the U.S. side is inadequate. So is the strategy then, apart from these horrible pictures of mounted Border Patrol officers on horses chasing Haitians with whips, they're apparently putting people on buses, taking them to the San Antonio airport and flying them directly to Haiti. Is that going to be the solution? Are they just going to, what did you say, 2,000 a day are going to be deported that way?
Yes, that's been the message from U.S. authorities. The head of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, was here in Del Rio today, and they really just reiterated that message that people will be removed from the bridge and will not be allowed to enter the U.S.
So did you have access? Are you able to speak to anybody on the Haitian side? I mean, not on the American side. You see, you can't even get into the encampment. They won't let the press in. They won't let press drones in. So when did you have access to these people? Presumably on the Mexican side.
Yes, in Ciudad Acuña, people are there buying food. Other people have decided to stay there for now and not risk going over to the U.S. side. So that's where we've been able to do our reporting.
So what do the people tell you? Do they tell you about their journeys, these hazardous journeys? Do they tell you about their hopes? Do they tell you about possible relatives and people they know in the United States? I mean, do you have any stories you can pass on to us?
Yes, I'd say for the most part, what I heard was, everyone has been through a very difficult journey. One of the parts that everyone tends to bring up is through Colombia and Panama. It's a jungle that people have to walk through. And also the treatment they've received. Someone was telling me about being robbed by a police officer in southern Mexico. So they've been through a very difficult journey. But also when I ask about the possibility of going back to Haiti, everyone wants to avoid that at any cost. I mean, people have mentioned the recent earthquake this summer, also the assassination of the president in July. So both the political instability and the kind of lack of basic services are some of the concerns people have told me about if they are forced to go back to Haiti.
And of course, many have already been flown back, and the press reports I've read, some of them didn't even know they were back in Haiti until they landed at Port-au-Prince. So
yes, it's very concerning if people aren't being, fully informed of their rights and the process going forward.
Well, Martha Piskorski, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Martha Piskorski, who is an environmental watchdog reporter at the El Paso Times, and she was previously a freelance journalist in Mexico reporting on the environment and immigration. And she has an article at the El Paso Times, Haitian Migrants Face Tough Choices in Del Rio Amid Crackdown on the Texas-Mexican Border. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing today's elections in Canada and how the COVID pandemic, which the Canadians have handled better than most countries, has become the main election issue.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Richard Johnson, a professor emeritus in political science, who until recently held the Canada Research Chair in Public Opinion, Elections, and Representation at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of a number of books, including Public Opinion and Public Policy in Canada, Questions of Confidence, and The Canadian Party System, and Analytic History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Johnston.
Happy to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it's a bit odd, at least from the point of view of calling you here from California. We just had a recall election here, of course, where COVID played a big part. But Canada is, 80% vaccinated? Probably the most successful campaign in the world in terms of what's called herd immunity. So how could the conservative leader, O'Toole, make an issue out of this in this election?
Well, we're down to crunch time, I guess you could say. To 80%, given the Delta variant, is not herd immunity. We have to get closer to 90%. And the only way to cover the last ground, if that's even possible, is through some kind of vaccine mandate or mandates. And Various of the provinces have moved to mandates, but it was generally the case that conservative provinces moved much less quickly than the federal. And in some sense, I think Mr. O'Toole is being wedged by the Liberals. Many, many of his supporters are opposed to vaccine mandates, even if they themselves are vaccinated. Though we also actually don't know how many of the Conservative candidates have received any of the vaccine.
So when he says, O'Toole, that Trudeau, he attacks him for being selfish and un-Canadian, what exactly is he implying there?
I guess he's implying, first of all, that selfishness is un-Canadian. Whatever. I mean, maybe it's the Ryan Reynolds factor. I don't know. Anyway, a number of things. I mean, one of the issues that Mr. O'Toole has tried to keep alive is the very fact that we're having an election. We are a Westminster system, although there is a law in the books that says that elections shall take place every 4 years. The fact is, as a full-on Westminster system, the Crown has a say in this matter as well. And Mr. Trudeau asked for a dissolution of Parliament because before the election, the polls suggested he might turn his minority government into a majority one. So it was greedy or selfish in that sense. But it was also selfish in the sense that the timing coincided with the surge of the Delta variant. We are having a pandemic of the unvaccinated here right now. It coincided with the collapse of Afghanistan. And we've also had our version of the heat wave, drought, and forest fires that Californians are living with. So in the middle of all of that, in face of objections from the major opposition parties to the effect that they were perfectly happy to sustain the government for the foreseeable future, given the pandemic emergency. In the face of that, he nonetheless decided that the country needed to turn a new corner, and to that end, it had to have an election. So there's your selfish thing. It also plays against a narrative of entitlement. Although it is a government of the left, Mr. Trudeau himself was born to privilege. The coalition that he, when I say coalition, I mean the kind of the coalition of forces that he represents are what sometimes are called the Brahmin left, people with international connections, university educations, and the right sort of thoughts. And among the friends of Mr. Trudeau is the Aga Khan, a major supporter of a foundation in his father's memory. Well, you shouldn't really be accepting helicopter trips to the man's private island while you're prime minister of a G7 country. So there's part of the narrative in the background of kind of entitlement on the part of the prime minister.
And what role is the People's Party of Canada, which I guess is a Trumpiest party in Canada? Their leader's been running on a platform of anger over vaccine mandates and lockdowns. They were pretty much in the wilderness until this election, where they've gone up from 1.6% vote share to 6%. Now, that's not enough, but would that vote hurt? By the way, would he be peeling votes away from O'Toole, the Conservatives?
Could I just point out, first of all, it is the vaccine mandate that's touched off everything here, right, including some pretty nasty confrontations at hospitals. The question of whether it will hurt the Conservatives is up in the air. The Conservatives may have lost a percentage point or two in the polls over the last couple of weeks, roughly coinciding with the increase in the people's share. Of course, we don't actually know what the increase in the people's share is. The range in polls is from currently about 4% to, I think, as high as 10% in a poll published yesterday or conducted yesterday. So it could be in the upper single digits. It could be in the lower single digits or somewhere in between. So we don't really know quite what it is. And a lot may hang on that. The other thing is, so there's some suggestion that Mr. O'Toole's rise was at least stalled. It's possible that it's a bit reversed. Whether you can actually attribute that to the rise of the People's Party isn't 100% clear. It seems reasonable in principle to conjecture that votes for them are votes that the Conservatives won't get or can't get. The People's Party is probably also pulling some people into the electorate who might not otherwise vote. They would not vote for the Conservatives because they're just not conservative enough. And so they weren't registering before, as in registering in the polls before. Everybody's registered here. It's possible, though, that they're also pulling in support, believe it or not, from the Greens. The Green Party in Canada, which for the last 15 years or so has been polling in the kind of middling single digits, has had at least one MP for the last decade and had three in the last parliament. It of course has many supporters who really are Greens, but it's also kind of a parking spot and a protest place for people who are disaffected with other parties. And some of those people are disaffected for reasons that are actually quite xenophobic and reactionary. And then there is in the Green vote the kind of West Coast phenomenon of general distrust in authority, not necessarily conservative orientation, but as I say, distrusting and libertarian.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Johnson, who is a professor emeritus of political science, who until recently held the Canada Research Chair in Public Opinion, Elections and Representation at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of a number of books, including Public Opinion and Public Policy in Canada, Questions of Confidence, and The Canadian Party System, An Analytic History. And we're talking about the Canadian elections today, which were called earlier by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, hoping to win a greater majority. He didn't have an absolute majority in Parliament. Had to form a coalition and wanted to be able to be obviously in a position to have a sufficient majority to pass without any other parties involved. And that's looking a little shaky, is it not? Now, traditionally, the Liberals, which Trudeau is the head of, they tend to do well in the eastern states, and the Conservatives in the plain states, I don't know about as far west as British Columbia. But I guess, could you say, Richard, that it's unlikely that Trudeau will get what he was hoping for, which is a bigger majority?
If the polls are correct to a close approximation, he's unlikely to get the majority. That's right. On the other hand, the geography of the vote is such that if he gets a modestly larger share in a number of closely contested ridings than he did last time, that minority could become a majority. If he gets a modestly smaller share in ridings that generally fit that description, he could lose a bunch of them, in which case most of them would go to the Conservative Party, although in this province, in British Columbia, they might go to the NDP. The NDP, for your information, is essentially a Labour party. It is a major party in the Western provinces. It is the government in British Columbia. It's a party that would be instantly recognizable to someone from the UK, New Zealand, or Australia. But in the rest of the country, it's relatively weak. And so, in fact, the NDP in some ways also stands in the way of an outright majority for Mr. Trudeau.
And the New Democratic Party, the NDP, is led by Jagmeet Singh, and it's polling higher, though, this time around, right? Would that make him a likely kingmaker in the next parliament?
It's possible. There is another possible kingmaker, and we need to talk about that. But it is true that in polls as of today, averaged across all of them, the NDP is pulling about 21% of the vote. They got 16 in 2019. So that would be a substantial increase. The trouble is that the polls in 2019 had him at 18. He finished up at 16. So it's possible that the industry as a whole has a bit of an NDP bias in terms of the composition of its samples. So maybe he doesn't really get 21. It could be 19. He certainly has a spoiler role in elections. And if he has more seats than he had last time, then he could basically be the pivot for government, which in effect he was last time anyway. It doesn't come down to the exact arithmetic. The question is one party and one party only in a position to decide which other party shall form the government? This time around, the Bloc Québécois may wind up taking more seats than last time. If that's the case, and also the Liberals get fewer seats than last time, the Bloc could become the kingmaker. That only in combination with them will any other party form the government. The Bloc is unlikely to support the Liberals, very unlikely to support the Liberals. They have suggested that they would be willing to support the Conservatives, or at least they haven't rejected the idea. But that would be a very awkward combination. Can I also just correct you on something you said earlier? We almost never have coalitions here. We do have minority governments occasionally, but it's very rare. It happened really only in the First World War that we had a across the aisles coalition, and it basically led to the destruction of one of the partners. So our parties are very reluctant to coalesce, and with good reason.
So I thought the whole point of what Trudeau did in calling this early election, this is the second election in 2 years, was because he wanted a bigger majority, that he had to rely on other parties for votes. So what other description would you have short of a coalition to get votes from other parties?
Well, obviously, it's a parliamentary system, right? And so the ongoing moral authority of a party to govern rests on its ability to get working majorities in the lower house of parliament. That's absolutely true. But working majorities are not the same thing as outright coalition. Coalition presupposes that more than one party has ministers in the cabinet. That has not happened in over 100 years in this country. And so instead, what you have is either issue by issue negotiation. Sometimes it's a game of chicken in which some or all parties in opposition are invited to support the government, and they can decide for themselves whether or not to. And if they don't, then the government falls on what is essentially a matter of confidence. But most of the time, because the costs of elections are high, because politicians value merely being in office, they're very reluctant to bring a government down unless they reckon from the polls that they can take advantage of it in the election that would ensue. So there is a certain chicken quality to the whole thing. Sometimes there will be what's called a confidence and supply agreement, where the smaller party agrees to support the larger party on all questions that are deemed to be questions of confidence. There's some room for negotiation over what is a question of confidence, but it always involves supply and ways and means. It always involves the speech from the throne, which is the government's program. And then such measures as the government deems to be somehow essential to its identity as the governing party. So it becomes a politics of maneuver. Obviously, other parties must support the governing party for it to survive, or at a minimum, they must stand down and not have their people vote. But that's not the same thing as the kind of thing you experience in many European countries, where you have formal coalitions with detailed agreements and a parceling out of cabinet positions. We don't do that.
So thanks for that correction. It's not like the Danish TV series Borgen. So
it is not.
That much we've learned here, and I'm glad for that. But just in closing, what role is foreign policy playing? You mentioned that the fall of Kabul to the Taliban definitely took the focus off Trudeau's intentions, and also this recent AUKUS agreement between the UK, the United States and Australia over nuclear submarines. It seems very conspicuous that Canada was left out of that. What role is foreign policy playing?
In this particular election, probably not much, except as part of a more general picture of a government that's not paying attention to all of the portfolios that it should. Certainly the AUKUS agreement was noticed. The Conservative Party are on the matter, pointing out that this shows that we don't matter for foreign policy when Australia does. It's an awkward fact. I would expect a Conservative government to have a foreign policy more closely aligned with that of the what we sometimes call the Anglosphere. We're conscious that we're one of the Five Eyes. Well, maybe the Five Eyes has become the Three Eyes. That bothers some people, but I think it comes along too late to influence this particular election. And then as far as the Afghanistan is concerned, there is really more that having committed to the war in Afghanistan for a decade and taking a lot of combat deaths, as a matter of fact, and with several thousand people who were inside Afghanistan working for the Canadian Armed Forces and the Government of Canada, who, as is the case with many countries, have just been left behind by the collapse of the regime. And so the Trudeau government is taking some of the heat for failing to get all of our friends, supporters, and allies inside Afghanistan out, for seeming to be less able to get planes to the airport than various of the NATO participants. So there's a sense in which it contributes to a feeling of diminished impact in the world, diminished importance, particularly for people whose conception of Canada's role in the world is one that is somewhat militarized, a bit more like Australian foreign policy than Canadian policy under the Liberals.
Well, Richard Johnston, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Johnston, who's a professor emeritus of political science, who until recently held the Canada Research Chair in Public Opinion, Elections and Representation at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of a number of books, including Public Opinion and Public Policy in Canada, Questions of Confidence, and The Canadian Party System, An Analytic History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews, searchable by topic, and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. When we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting now that I have resigned from Pacifica. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.